A small point on the validation versus the training accuracy is also when we use such things like dropout, it is something that is reflected differently on the evaluation of the training set and on the validation set. So that could also be one part of the explanation for the behavior we see on the validation and training.
That's right. Actually, we might want to try to rerun it where we don't throw well, where the 40% well, some other value. Mm-hmm. What if we go for
one relatively typical use value is also 25.
Yeah.
So we could try to decrease it a bit.
All right. And meanwhile, please try to rerun. Or let's go for 0.1. We want to see an effect here.
Yeah.
All right. And meanwhile, Carl says, it should be noted that when training on GPUs, larger batch sizes reduces the training time as larger chunks of data can be transferred to the GPU. The GPU likes fewer and larger chunks when talking about performance, of course, up to a certain limit. However, a large batch size might decrease the accuracy of the trained model. Thanks, Carl. Good input. And we are training again.
And actually, I am not sure that I ran this part. Oh, we'll see.
Ah, okay. well, the loss starts very low. It was much higher before.
Yeah. So it probably did then.
So it probably did. Yeah. While we wait and sit and look at epochs counting up, which is not an uncommon task in CNN training, I just wanted to ask around regarding the final project. So one more group wrote, but by now, I think you should have an idea of a group and, well, it's more important that you have a group than a subject, but it's nice if you also have a subject or data. And before the end of the week, it would be very nice to finalize this. So my question in general, and I'll write it out, is should I hereby assume that everybody else haven't thought about it and would like to just be randomly assigned a group? Or do you want to work by yourself? Or and what data do you have? Please write me, and by Friday I'll start making some suggestions based on the information I have, which might be nothing, and then you might get surprised by these suggestions, but that's so please write me. And as always, if you think, okay, who's out there, well, the option is also just to write me saying I'm by myself, I would like to work with others, I like the subject, or I don't care, or I suggest the subject, and we'll do a small bazaar. You can also write on Slack and Discord and in the chat here. Call me, anything. All right. What are we at now? 98. Oh. What happened now? Is this something?
It might be because this was changed after. Yeah. So, unfortunately, I will just rerun it.
All right. Meanwhile, Carl quantifies his statement. So, Yeah, well, here it's a good quantification because Carl is running on a GPU, and he has batch size 128, and then it takes 2.35 seconds for, per epoch, and with batch size 1024, it takes 1.16 seconds per epoch. Now that shows both the speed of the GPU, because that's a factor, well, it's 40 seconds here, so that's a factor 20 faster. And yeah, but the accuracy goes down as you put up the batch size.
And here we can also see why training on GPUs are very, very necessary parts when building larger scale networks also.
Yeah. May I ask you, where do you train?
For this notebook?
No. When you train on GPUs?
Well, we have some machines at the office, but we can also use GPUs over ADA.
Yeah. And the ADA GPUs, is that something you need to, well, you need to register for them, I think, right?
I am pretty sure, I think Carl can also expand on this, but I'm pretty sure that if you have access to ADA, you have access to using a more or less standard GPU. But of course, for the more expensive machines, I think you need to be registered, yes.
Okay, but there is, interesting. Carl might be writing right now. He can also speak up. yeah, well, and clearly he's running it there. Just a quick vote among, please write yes if you run things on ADA and no if you run things on your own computer. Please give me a few yeses and nos. It's cool that you write it in the chat, but if you do it by clicking the yes and no's, then it counts up automatically. So please do that. But I saw a lot of no's here. Okay. Yeah. Well, anyhow, that's an example of why there's an advantage of running it on a large machine. Ah, okay. And that's the reason for not speaking. All right, Carl. You're excused. Yeah. So, what was the result now?
All right. So, we got a bit of an increase.
Yeah. So we got a better result, but we're also, you know, having a larger network because we didn't drop that much.
Yeah.
Exactly. And also in the training and testing, at least in the fifth epoch, the loss functions, their accuracy became closer to each other. Mm-hmm. It's still a strange order.
Yeah. But this could also be due to the dropout process by itself.
Okay.
But yes, generally when we look at the number of parameters for this relatively shallow network, the 40% dropout that we started with initially is also a very large rate. So orders of around 10%, like the current one, does make more sense.
Okay, cool. Imagine we changed the kernel size to 5, right? That would be a radical change in approach because suddenly it looks at a larger area. Now, should we try that? Of course, that makes it much bigger.
Mm-hmm. And we can just keep...
If we start just one of them, not the second one, because the second one is a smaller image, so... Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll try to see that. Yeah. also, in the end, you chose to test on only 2,000. I would have thought that validating on 5,000 and testing on 5,000 would be, that's how I would have chosen it.
Yeah, that was somewhat of a of an arbitrary choice.
The 80-10-10. Okay.
Yes, naturally, we want as much data, both for validation, so we can actually evaluate our model performance. But naturally, if we have a tiny test set, it becomes difficult to properly evaluate our model on unseen data.
Yeah. And since here, the number of digits that we get wrong in the end, if you, while running, go down to the confusion matrix, is very small, right? Then you might see what you think is a great performance increase by randomly just going from one being correct to the other in the test set. Yeah, so that might be an option. Also, 27 in total. That's yeah, that's not a lot.
27. You can estimate it as a Poisson number. So, like, the uncertainty on that 27 is probably on the order of square root of 27. Just to have an estimate of how much the uncertainty on your wrongness is.
Yes. Yes. At least some number is applied statistics.
So in this case, plus minus five, roughly. So our estimate on how good we are is plus minus 20% of, which is a lot.
Yeah. Now, it seems. See, you might think that with a bigger kernel, that it does better, but that's not necessarily so. You might wash out local effects. And it only has 16 filters to play with, so it's not a lot.
The depth is definitely, I would assume, a limiting factor of this architecture. But also a very, very good way of verifying what the filter size actually does to the output. So just like I mentioned, if we start with a very crude model and try to make cause changes.
All right. Do we get above 99 with this 5x5 to begin with? Well, judging from the improvement in the others, it's hard to say, but maybe. Probably. Nope.
All right, but a Morse conversion curve.
Yeah, on the accuracy. All right. You know what? I think it's time for people to play around with this, and yeah, the answer is it's amazingly simple to set up. It's a bit like chess. It's easy to set up, but it's hard to run well. So let me just ask, wasn't there a second part of presentations? Yes, at 11:30, I'll just mention an example used that we had on CERN data. Because as it turns out, our so-called calorimeters are built much like pixels. And for that reason, we said, all right, maybe we can use this. And the answer was, yeah, definitely an improvement. Haider has a good question here. So anyway, now it's play around and ask questions and so on. And at 11:30, I'll talk about our usage of it on CERN data, for example, or LHC data. But Haider asks, why is there such a huge discrepancy between the growth of the parameters and the growth of the epoch time? When I run 5,000 parameters only, it takes 10 seconds. but 20,000 runs in 15 seconds. Do you want to talk about that, or?
Well, that could be due to what you are running on, first of all.
Yeah. Okay, well, reading in time might be a substantial part which doesn't change. Handling four times more parameters doesn't take four times longer because the limitation is not the GPU, it's also the input output.
Mm-hmm. Yes, just like Carl mentioned before, to a certain limit, we can expect a certain relationship on the GPU. But again, the limiting factor is not the computations on the GPU, but just like Troel said, the transferring of data.
Which GPU are you running on, Haider? A 1080, I don't know what GPU that is.
It's a relatively high-end NVIDIA.
Yeah, yeah, sure, but is it in your, is it one that you have in your room or somewhere out there or, ah, dang, all right, some are privileged. all right. A quick question. If you want to run TensorFlow on ERDA, then you should take which entry when you log in on DAG?
I think that is something that Carl can explain.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it. It's the one called TensorFlow. Ah, okay. It's not the data science one. That's what I would have thought. Okay. And then... Ah, yeah. Then Jonathan has a general question. All right. And that's regarding the small project. So he's trying to transfer, normalize, and standardize the input features. But the question is if he should transform the target values in the training data as well. And how do I make sure that I transform the test data correctly so that the predictions correspond as well as possible to the tested target values? Which is not known. No, the answer is you don't necessarily need to change or to normalize or standardize or transform in any way the target values, but you can do it. Now, for energy, for example, in this case, the energies do not span a very large range, right? The smallest is probably 10 or 15 GV, and the highest is 150. So it spans one order of magnitude. But let's say it spanned many orders of magnitude, and that's a typical case. Well, in this case, a transformation that often works well is just to take the log 10 of the energy, because now the numbers would span from 0 to 1 or from 0.3 to 1.3. You know, something that neural networks like. And well, if you transformed the targets, then when you get an answer, you would just have to take it, you know, 10 to the power of the number. You would need to transform it back to hit the target. And that would go for the training and the test set, you know, in the exact same manner. So I'm not sure I understand your last question. you should transform the test set in the same way as you transform the training and validation set. All right, cool. Yeah, well, Alexander, I'm thinking so that everybody has something to look at. Let's go up to the top again. And imagine that we want to change the architecture so that we actually put in a third layer. How does that sound?
All right. So perhaps adding the convolution layer.
Yeah, another convolution and another max pooling, right?
Mm-hmm. All right.
And now we have to think about filters and kernel sizes and so on. So kernel size 5, let's go away from that. That was a small test.
So if we start on perhaps 16 is fine, and then
go to 32. In the second layer, and stay at 32 in the third, or go to 64?
I think we should increase it, perhaps keep it at 16 here.
Yeah. All right. And we keep the stride the same, because can't see why we wouldn't. And then we put the dropout rate at perhaps 25%. Something more reasonable. Yeah. Want to try? All right. While we look at all the epochs evolve, and so now it takes a little longer. Nah, not that. The estimate falls. But if you go up, then let's look at the number of parameters again.
So we actually decreased.
We actually decreased it because in the end, the dense layer only gets the dense 1-3 gets fewer inputs, and that's where the large number of parameters is.
Exactly.
All right. Heider's asking. Carl is responding. It's not a response. Okay, so Haida asks, is there any particular reason the second convolution layer is twice the size of the first? I tried changing it so that the second layer has exactly as many filters as the first, and it led to a relatively large decrease in accuracy, even when someone conserving the amount of parameters by increasing other layers. Yeah.
So first of all, there is no particular reason that it is twice the size, and it is not uncommon at all to see that that you have the same size for two consecutive layers, especially for very deep networks. You are sometimes interested in having partial symmetrical layers. So you write a decrease in accuracy even when conserving the amount of parameters. So that could be that the structure of the layers do not span the parameter space well enough to capture the interesting features. So again, an argument built on the capacity of the network, which is, yeah. And also a good point that Carl mentions, that you can use Google Colab with the GPUs available. I know I have used that in earlier courses, and it has worked very well for CNN.
I think that's what they mainly made it for, you could say.
All right. So we got an increase.
Yeah.
With all one right. Layer deeper.
Let's try to go look at where it got things wrong. Some of the wrong pictures. And by the way, I think this is a very, very, very good thing to do. You need to look at where does it, you know, make mistakes. The actual individual, yeah.
All right.
So. There's something about the fives that it doesn't like, and it predicts 3 and 6.
Mm-hmm. So we can see some of the shape is quite similar, besides this part, which should be over here. But also the 8 is kind of surprising.
Yeah. But it has fewer errors, right? And the 5 predicted as a 0 is still there, and probably everybody will get that wrong, right?
Yeah. And that now, really looks
say,
like
you say 10. How about putting the range up to 20 so we can see almost all the errors it made? Right, there were 21 errors, so it's just a 4x5. Okay, let's see that. Yeah, I know the distance and so on. Never mind that.
All right. So one common thing is the 5. 14.
25x14, that's of course what it should Okay. And now we can inspect. Haider, thanks for the replace. Do we know why this happens, Alexander?
Well, there have been some changes when shifting to TensorFlow 2.0, and there have been made some compatibility modules. So some things are not in use any longer, but if you want to use them, you can import them and such. The reason why I chose to do it through TensorFlow was simply just the shortest possible solution, such that the notebook was not focused too much on,
But I might take Haider's suggestion and put in a comment and out saying, you know, if you get an error here, try this instead.
Yeah. Good idea.
And thanks for the solution, Heide.
We can generally see a pattern of typically the 5 and 8, which are misrepresented.
Yeah. Ask God, I get a not implemented error.
So I also just wanted to mention that on the last slide, there is a different link also besides the one we already looked at with the 3D visualization. There is a different interactive CNN model where you can change the parameters, you can change the input images, and you can play around with it. It's from a quite a new newly released paper where they focus on the intuition behind CNNs and trying to explain it. So I would strongly suggest people who are interested to looking deeper into it.
All right, well, it's going to run for a little while. And again, I suggest that, well, we keep the line open, but everybody, well, now we can see what Alexander is doing. But otherwise, remember to stretch your legs and take some time off and drink and eat. And then in 15 minutes, approximately, I'll tell what we've been playing around with this for CERN use. Cool. All right, I'll manage. I managed to troll through my mail, and I got a few regarding groups for final project. But I would love to get more by the end of the day. Don't hesitate to write, as I said, and I'll also be writing up. 3 minutes to start. Alrighty. Towards the end here of the morning session, I simply wanted to show you something that we had worked on where we used exactly CNNs and where you would say, that's, you know, is that an image? But it just goes to show what we mean by that it can be used for a great variety of things. So, here is a presentation that I actually gave for the Atlas collaboration at CERN. Can everybody see it now? Well, I can't see the chat, so I'll put the chat up here. Yep. All right. So what we do is that we say our calorimeter in Atlas is actually segmented into what you could almost call pixels. We call them cells, but they are square, and hence they work like pixels in an image. And what they're made of, it doesn't matter, and our competitor experiment made their calorimeter out of special crystals which means that you take, I think they tried out 20 different compounds, and you put it together and you heat it up, and then you let it slowly drop in temperature, and then you get a solid block, and then you smash it with a hammer, and then you find a small crystal in it, and then you put it in vacuum and let it grow, and when you have something that's reasonably large, you polish out a crystal, and then you do that 300,000 times to get a calorimeter with 300,000 cells in that can see if particles hit them and how much energy they put in. And why would you ever do that? Well, that's because you want to search for the Higgs particle. And the plot here shows actually one of the discovery channels of the Higgs. So here you have the on the x-axis the invariant mass between two photons, which is one of the things the Higgs was predicted to decay to. And here you have a histogram of the number of events you have of that type. And the problem is that you do get two photons in when you collide protons unrelated to the Higgs. It's the small bump here, which is the addition. And if you have a hard time seeing it, I can understand why. But if you subtract the background, it suddenly becomes clear. Now, your ability to do any research of this kind depends on getting the sharpness of this peak right. It would be almost a delta function if you had infinite energy resolution. And that's why our competitors went through the trouble, and I can tell you amount of money, to build a crystal calorimeter, to have the sharpest peak. And that relates entirely to having the best energy resolution. So it relates very much to the small project, except that in the small project, it's electrons instead, but they do very similarly. So you will see this work for electrons and photons. And now, what does our calorimeter look like? Well, it's not an ordinary image. It has four channels, but the channels have a very, very different resolution and thickness, which means the main calorimeter is this. And here you see that the channel or the pixel are pretty square. And this is where most of the energy is deposited. Now, the layer before it, which is the next two most important, is highly segmented in one direction and little in another direction. And there are physics reasons for that. Never mind. It's just different than that. And so all four layers are different. Now, what do you do then? Well, and what did we have? Well, the fun thing is we had more than just this data. We also had variables that describe things from the outside. And they are described here, and never mind what they are. But here it's a mix of images and scalar variables. And what were the energies that we were considering? Well, here we actually had three orders of magnitude in energies, and for photons, two orders of magnitude, meaning we actually took the log 10 of the energy. So here we did a transformation of the target. And then here's the pipeline of the analysis. So you take the events and the feature selection and you construct images. And then you split it into training, validation, and testing. And you don't test that until you get to the end. And well, then you fit it and then you put scalars on top. And I'll get back to how do you put those on top? What do you do? And then you have a trained model and you test for early stopping using the validation set and you do hyperparameter optimization again and again and again. And when you're done with that, then you fit the control set. All right. And this was done, we ran it on between 1 and 8 GPUs, and that was the limiting factor. It could take an entire weekend to do. So now what does the CNN look like here? Well, we have the images, and then what we did was we upsampled them because the images had different structures, and then you could do a CNN on each type of images. So we had four different images each type, but then you miss the problem that the backpropagation has a hard time going between the relation between the images. So then it doesn't really work that well. It did work, but it didn't work that well. So we upsampled them to be 55 by 56, still very small images. And then we did a convolution and a max pooling and a convolution and a max pooling and a convolution and a max pooling and so on. And note here at the end, you know, the images were small, but we had quite a few filters, 256. And then how do you use the scalars? Well, first you take the scalars and you put them into a neural network, which spits out, well, not the scalar values, but rather, you know, some representation of them in a higher dimension. And then you say, all right, when I did in the first case here, the convolutions, now I have 16 images that I get out of the same size. And then you say, all right, when I put those together, then I don't want to just add them up, but I want to weigh them so that the important ones get more weight than the others. This was the bias term, but here you can now do it as a function of the scalars, right? Because the scalars are fed in to give a linear function, beta and gamma, by which you add and multiply each of the images you get out. And this you do for all of them. And then at the end, you take and flatten the whole thing. And then you have a last neural network, which then feeds out your estimate of the energy, right? So this, and this film is called film. This technique, feature-wise linear modulation. So you linearly modulate based on features. All right. The other thing that you would normally do, and that we did to begin with, was to take the scalars and just put them straight in here. Well, then you get thousands of values from here and 15 from the scalars, and sometimes they tend to drown. They didn't drown. We did test, you know, if it could see them, but it turned out that this was the better way of doing it. All right. And then we did things in Keras TensorFlow, and the metric we used was this relative error. We said, energy estimated minus energy true divided by energy true. So that took the scale out of the problem, three orders of magnitude. But the estimated energy was done through a log 10 transformation. And then to evaluate, we did interquantile range. So where is the point of 25 and 75%? And for comparison to what Atlas, the collaboration, had already, we just set the ratio. All right. So now we look at the relative improvement over here. And you can see that, well, the blue is what was there already. And then the more things we put in here, the better it got. And you see from the yellow to the green, this is when we really improve. We take 14 parameters and put them in this film. And yeah, the improvement is substantial. And just keep in mind, you might say, why do you want to go through so much trouble to get this? Well, it wasn't that much trouble. And these are quarter billion Danish crowns calorimeters, the performance of which we can improve. So it's worthwhile. And we also see that we improve generally when we include this in a physics analysis. Here it's the Z boson. All right. So the result on electrons were an improvement of about 20%. And the number of parameters, I can say that we started with an algorithm which had 22 million parameters. And now we managed to boil it down to 3.5. So that's the size of it. And the training samples were large. I think we had about between 1 million and 4 million images, meaning that, you know, yeah, it took a while to train. Let's just say that. And never mind, you know, we did investigations on where do you improve and so on. And then we tried for photons. And for photons, the increase was even larger. And I can say that to begin with, we also divided the detector into three parts. Never mind. You see the 20 million parameters, and we divided it up. But it turned out that, you know, you don't need to do that. So we redid it all, not dividing the detector. The results, well, I'll skip over these results because there's a lot of technicalities in it. But the results remained and actually, in some cases, got slightly better because the more general an algorithm that you use, sometimes the more generalizes into catching all the cases where in your test set that you haven't seen before. So here are the improvements in the end. What are they improving over? I forgot to say that. Well, they were improving over saying we, instead of using all single cells, we do various sums of them. And then we do a machine learning algorithm on those sums. So this is an improvement of quite a bit compared to what is already a machine learning algorithm. It just didn't use the images. And you might say, is that an image of an electron? Well, admittedly, a strange one, just the readout from a calorimeter, transforming it into an energy. But that's also to be considered an image. More technical plots. But then, just to say, are we done here? No, not necessarily. It turns out that in addition to the images that contained the energy, we also had, what time did the detector part see this signal? How noisy is that detector part? And what is it switched on to detect? So that means you could actually have several more images in and feed them in, perhaps through some gate here. And it turns out that we also have more auxiliary information, which could be put in and used either in the film or directly into the top network. Quite a few things to do. Of course, when you do the full model, things also become more heavy. And so simplicity is a virtue, I should remind you. That's what we played around with. And I think actually the really fun thing was discovering that this film technique was quite handy. And I'm sure that since then, other more advanced techniques than this have shown the light of day. Maybe not with this, but at least alternatives have shown. Yeah. Any questions? Please just speak up. You're also welcome to write, but please speak up.
I would just like to say that I really like the figure on page 6. I think it's a very good illustration of the whole process and gives a very nice idea of all the various bits that goes into this very intricate model.
Thanks a lot. It does take the train, get an idea of the early stopping, and then change hyperparameters and do it again, and so on. It took a while. It was driven by a student of mine called Frederik Feier, who admittedly, it took him a while before he had any results, right? Before spit out anything that was even, having an idea of the energy. Yeah. Other questions? No. Was it that clear? Roni asks, what does the bias correction involve? That involves the fact that now you asked. It involves the effect that when you optimize the output, yeah, let me just take something here. Then you ask it to predict close to the truth, and we used the, well, sometimes we used the mean absolute error, sometimes the mean absolute deviation, and sometimes the RMS on that number, on that distribution here. And as it turns out, then it doesn't care too much about whether it's exactly in the middle. So if it has a tail that's longer on one side than the other, and there is a tail that's longer on this side than this, then it might actually pay to move the mean away, or the median. And that means that it, when you search for your Higgs, suddenly you get the Higgs mass peaking at a different place, which is not what you want. So then you say, all right, we want to correct that bias. And ideally, we would have loved to have done it in the loss function. But these loss functions, you know, you didn't see the loss function in the CNN just before. Oh, sorry. So, and that's because it's hidden away. Writing your own loss function is not impossible at all, but you have to be clever in doing it because you need the derivative, the second derivative of it as well. So, yeah, that was the bias correction. Good question. And as you can see, when doing this stuff, you do all sorts of things to check, do we really understand where the performance is coming from and where it's making errors and whatnot. Yeah. No other questions? Don't tell me that it was that clear. Perhaps it's closer to lunch than it was clear. I'll be assuming that. I put this talk up, so you're also welcome to ask me questions afterwards. All right, then I'm going to stop sharing. Go back. And by the way, Alexander, I wanted to talk to you about this. There's an interesting development in it. But we can just talk afterwards.
Yeah.
Finally, I want to ask regarding the final project, the forming of groups. Do you have any questions or comments regarding this, or should I just start suggesting groups? Or yeah. I just want to ensure that nobody sits back alone. Is it because most people just want to do it by themselves or with one other person that they haven't written me? And in that case, they should just write me if you have an idea. Or is it because people don't have an idea? None of the two. Well, it's hard to gauge. So, well, we'll discuss that further in the afternoon, and also the well, towards the end of the week. So, but actually trying out a machine learning project over a couple of weeks with your peers and with all the guidance and help that we can come with is, I think, one of the best ways to actually become proficient in this, see what it really entails. Yep. Well, then I'll stop recording here. And I'll see you 1:15. If you stay on the line, Alexander, that would be cool.
Yep.